Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
We need to have universal psychiatric care. For me, it's been the thing that when I push back to conservatives, because we do agree on a lot of aspects of what I'm saying, that's the most difficult pill in San Francisco to swallow. And I am finding that when you kind of pair these things, which is basically enforce the law, shelter first, housing earned. So housing's not a right. Housing's something you would earn through abstinence or compliance with psychiatric care and universal psych. That's an agenda that, I mean, it's even hard when you look at that whole agenda to be like, that's a right wing or that's a left wing agenda. I do think it sits more comfortably right now in the center right. I'm totally fine with that. But yeah, I mean, my ambitions are, I would love to see Republicans pick up both a nuclear heavy climate agenda and a shelter first, housing earned, universal psychiatry agenda when it comes to homelessness. If that happened, I'd be delighted.
Happy Thursday, everybody. If you are watching this on YouTube, you will see that Golda has made her triumphant return. She managed to not bark during this episode of Michael Schellenberger we just recorded. So as a reward, she gets to continue to make her YouTube debut. If you are listening to this on audio, definitely go check out and say hi. She is a huge fan of everybody. But this episode is a great one. It's with Michael Schellenberger. I mentioned this before. He is the author of San Francisco, How Progressives Ruin Cities. I know. You heard that title. You heard the dunking on progressives. And you said, Marshall and Sagar, you two just did an episode dunking on the new culture wars. You talk about how labels are bad. Despite everything in the title, Sagar, why is this conversation with Michael, which is the second time I've had him on the show, why is it worth it? And why is there something here?
Yeah, I mean, we asked Michael that at the very top. I was like, look, what is this really about? I'm like, is this like some boomer Fox News book, or is this like a real attempt to say what the hell happened to San Francisco and to a lot of different American cities, and can we fix it? And I'm convinced that it is the latter. I think Michael's a very good faith guy. He talks a lot about his own journey through trying to, you know, to push for decriminalization or for, you know, for homelessness initiatives and more, and kind of his awakening and how he thinks that we can have a middle ground between just like a lock 'em up approach and an outright just permissibility of a lot of the stuff that we see on the streets of San Francisco, of LA, of Austin, and elsewhere. So I think people will get a lot out of this. If you want to know why this exactly happened and what a way to get out of this and do something about it, I think this is the right episode for you.
And something he does that's very important is acknowledge from the start that, look, if you're talking about the problems you're encountering in any city, San Francisco, New York, where I live, DC, where Sagar lives, Austin, Texas, if you're vibey and moving, basically everywhere except Miami to a certain degree, this is a conversation which is entirely within either the Democratic Party or the progressive left. So Michael is coming to this perspective not as a Fox News conservative, but as a what he calls a traditional liberal who is not quite aligned with like the more traditional figures here. But the bit of nuance that I'll just add here before we get into the quick shout outs here is, look, what is a progressive in these contexts? London Breed, the mayor of San Francisco, I'm sure Fox News would probably call her a progressive, but she just joined the supporting of the recall of three, frankly, pretty woke board members in the city. What does that mean? Eric Adams, mayor of New York City. Yep. I would have described him as a progressive before he beat Andrew Yang. But if you're looking at what he's actually doing, he's very clearly a more centrist Democrat. So these labels, what they mean, the coalitions, they're constantly shifting. But I think there's so much here. You guys are really going to get a kick out of this. Quick shout outs before we get into the episode. This is, of course, a book show. So you can purchase Michael's books at our bookshop. There is a link in the show notes. We get 10% to support the show. Michael gets his book purchase and an independent bookseller is supported as well. Secondly, it is Thursday. That means that there is a Substack coming out with additional commentary, interaction with the audience. Lots of great stuff there. Lastly, Sagar, take us out with a shout out to our friends and sponsors.
Yeah, shout out to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. Lincoln Network, not the Lincoln Project, which is basically a project to light the money on fire of a lot of white suburban liberals. But that's a topic for another day. Let's get to it.
We will never discuss that topic on an actual podcast episode out of pushback against people who mislabel us. Here we go. Here's the show.
Michael Schellenberger. Welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, welcome back to The Realignment. Since the last time we did this was audio only, but it's good to actually see your face this time. Michael, the book that you've written, very provocative, it's gotten a lot of attention, San Francisco, How Progressives Ruin Cities. I think the title itself kind of frames it ideologically in a person's mind who may not know you as some sort of like Fox News, Tucker Carlson type thing, but having followed your work, having interviewed you in the past and listened to your stuff, I know that that's not the case. Tell us why you decided to write this book. Is it a good faith attempt to actually explain what happened in San Francisco and California and other cities? Or is this, you know, like a partisan culture war cudgel? Look at all the poop on the side of the sidewalks. What do you think?
For sure. I mean, I wrote the book because I love San Francisco. I've been here for almost 30 years now. I live in Berkeley across the bay. Met my wife in San Francisco. Love the city. I still consider myself a liberal. I don't consider myself a progressive, certainly not after writing the book, but for sure wanted to make a good faith effort. I think if you read the book, you'll see that it is a book that quotes a lot of progressive people, a lot of liberal people expressing concerns. This is less of a personal book than Apocalypse Never was. The subtitle, you know, it's the most accurate subtitle. That's the question I had, which is, why did progressives do this? So obviously the first part of that is an argument that this is on progressives. We can't blame Reagan, as many of the people that I interview in the book attempt to do and fail. Reagan was governor over 50 years ago. He was president, you know, well over 35 years ago. San Francisco has been governed by progressives since the 70s. So this is really on progressives. But yeah, it's not great news. It's a disaster of governance. It's a very wealthy city. And so we have basically what Europeans accurately call open drug scenes, and which we have euphemistically referred to as homeless encampments. And those are not a consequence of poverty. Those are a consequence of our wealth and really of subsidizing and enabling street addiction and not treating mental illness.
You know, this is interesting. I'm glad you set this up with you as a liberal in opposition to those who you call progressive. I want to understand what you mean by these terms, because as you've said, and it's very clear in the book, I really appreciate how in-depth you went on the policy here. This is a 30, 40-year story. And the folks who did a lot of the groundwork on a lot of the policies they're pushing back against, they probably wouldn't have referred to themselves as progressives because that term wasn't in vogue in the same way that it became into its fore really in the 2000s. So just what is a progressive? Who are the progressives? And what is a liberal in the way that you're framing it?
Super great question. And let me just start by saying, I think that the meaning of those words is in question and is being contested. And I'll attempt to tell you how I think the words are being used, since I think that determines their definition. But again, I think there's some difference of opinion here. I mean, the word progressive is obviously a venerable old term. It tended to refer to urban reformers, public health reforms. You know, Teddy Roosevelt, you know, used the word progressive to describe himself. I think the word really comes back in the 90s or early 2000s. In part in a reaction to George H.W. Bush demonized the word liberal in the late 1980s. Many of us, including myself, who were radical left, started describing ourselves as progressives. I started describing myself as progressive really when I was somewhere in between radical left and liberal. And it was a powerful term. John Podesta obviously picked it up to use to describe the Center for American Progress, which is a heavily, very influential center-left or left think tank in Washington, D.C. I think it was progressive was a powerfully unifying term for the radical left and liberals at a time when we needed to be unified. Since then, however, and I wrote an essay recently called Why I'm Not a Progressive, for me, the meaning has changed so significantly from really, for me, being tied to a sense of overcoming, of heroism. Think of Rosie the Riveter. Think of Barack Obama 2007. yes, we can. Today, I see at the center of the category progressive victim ideology or victimology, which really is three things. The first is that you can divide the world into victims and oppressors. The second is that that status is frozen. So rather than victim status being something that you experience on a road to heroism, you're frozen in it by nature of your identity or experience. And then I think the third part of it is the idea that to victims only things should be given and nothing required. And so there's a sort of a charitable, which is very different from the radical left historically. It's not a story of revolution. It's a story of really maintaining dependency and charity. So what we see in San Francisco right now is we have literally hundreds of people, thousands of people, 5,000 people roughly, unsheltered, living on the streets, often in tents where they are given cash, free needles, drug paraphernalia, and in some cases, drugs and alcohol to maintain their addiction, because the idea is that it would be wrong to demand anything from people who have been defined as victims. So for me, that's how the word progressive has evolved over time and why I no longer call myself a progressive.
Those are very important terms. And let's get to, you know, not to parse too much of the sentence, but you say ruin cities. What does it mean to ruin a city? I assume, you know, we're starting out from a point of where there was a desirable living condition, and now we're living in an undesirable living condition. What does that actually look like in practice as you lay out in the book?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you had to kind of go from what did San Francisco look like before it was ruined, you could start with Vertigo, the great Hitchcock film of beautiful San Francisco, the San Francisco of Hollywood, the San Francisco of dreams, to basically through the 80s up until today, to where you have open drug scenes. So for me, the most iconic photo of San Francisco right now is a photo of tents separated in front of City Hall. And the tents are all full of people in late stage addiction, often suffering mental illness, literally in tents, living in terrible conditions, right there in the city center, right there in the downtown. So when I say ruined, I mean really unsafe, unlivable, but worse than that, really depriving the city of its humanity and its dignity. Because the experience, first of all, it's terrible, the treatment. We know that the way to treat addicts is that addicts require intervention. If they're not going to get intervention from friends and family, they need it when they break the law, which is often frequent. And if you don't provide that, I think it's inhumane. But it's also a degradation of all of our humanity to be subsidizing what I think are unethical practices. So it's a ruining not just of cities, but also really civilization, since cities are at the center of, I think, what we mean by civilized life.
Something I'm wondering here, San Francisco is part of the title, but the broader claim you're making is that progressivism ruins cities. So let's take a step back and expand this argument to the broader, let's say, urbanized regions of the country. And in the book jacket, it really describes how you categorize these arguments around three different areas. So homelessness, inequality, crime. There are certain progressive approaches to those three issues. So in a non-San Francisco, but often San Francisco context, how does the progressive mindset, in your viewpoint, cause problems specifically in those three areas?
Yeah, so great question. The main way or fundamental is this idea that we should treat people we categorize as victims differently from other people. And that includes addicts, that includes people of color, that includes the poor, that includes the mentally ill. And the idea is that we shouldn't require anything from them, including obeying the law. And so we have stopped enforcing many laws in San Francisco, but also in Los Angeles, Seattle, Portland, even places like Denver, Philly, because we, meaning we liberals or people that live in those cities, view enforcing the law against people that we categorize as victims as immoral. I worked for George Soros' foundation in the late 1990s. I worked on drug decriminalization. I worked on harm reduction. I worked with Maxine Waters to organize civil rights leaders to support needle exchange, which is important to preventing the spread of HIV/AIDS. I still support needle exchange. I still support decriminalization. But when I stopped doing that work around the year 2000, my understanding was that we were going for a policy to make drug rehabilitation, drug treatment, an alternative to incarceration, not optional. And what we've done is we've made it optional so that if people are, people aren't being arrested. But the idea would be that if you are, you know, breaking laws outside of your home, nobody, certainly not me, is interested in chasing down addicts. If they want to kill themselves in the privacy of their own home smoking fentanyl, I think it's terrible, but I don't think we should be using taxpayer money to arrest them. But usually if your addiction has led you to defecate in public, camp in public, use drugs in public, engage in shoplifting to support your habit, the idea, in my view, should be that you would be arrested like they do in Europe, brought to the police station, brought before a judge, and given the opportunity to get your life together through drug rehabilitation, psychiatric care, whatever it is that you need, according to, you know, psychiatric evaluation under the supervision of the courts. We're just not doing that. We just basically have stopped. And the excuse that's been given to me, or that was given to me, was that we're not doing it because we don't have any money. So one of the things I'm most proud of in San Francisco is that we spent a huge amount of time, my colleagues and I, just documenting how much money we spent. It's not a problem of money. We have a ton of money. We're not doing it because we don't think it's right to require or coerce people, even when we know that their behaviors are emerging from their untreated mental illness or addiction. We've stopped enforcing the laws because we don't think it's right to enforce the laws against so-called victims.
Something that's always interested me about your work, and is a point of tension, no doubt, with critics, is that you're writing these books, whether it's on climate change, whether it's on city policy, where there are a lot of people in the right or on the right who could pick up what you're saying and say, see, San Francisco is terrible. See, New York City is terrible during COVID. See, the Biden-Obama approach to climate change doesn't work. But at the same time, like, they're obviously just like not interested in those topics, right? Like Fox News, I'm sorry, doesn't care about the issue of like income inequality. So let's put that to aside for a second, because what it seems like you're trying to do in the best faith version of your work is really have a debate amongst people on the center left to progressives. Because once again, whether it's climate change, that's a Democratic Party debate. Whether it's homelessness and city policy, that is a Democratic Party and broadly left debate. So how do you see these debates happening within the actual communities that are playing a role in governing here? Because I think something that I want to just push to the audience real quick, who's skeptical, is Michael is saying controversial things, but a lot of center-left people will tell you off the record every single thing that he's saying. So I really do want to make clear, and I don't just mean random Twitter people, I mean like very prominent people who've come on this show, will effectively say what Michael is saying too. So can you just speak to how this debate is actually operationalizing itself?
Yeah, thank you, by the way, for surfacing it. I mean, the main criticism I got last year when we published Apocalypse Never was that I allowed myself to be used by climate deniers, Fox News and the right, to promote the book, promote my message. I haven't gotten quite that same thing here, but I think similarly, someone could say you're allowing yourself to be used by nefarious actors who are not operating in good faith to just denigrate liberal cities. And I think it's I don't agree with the criticism, obviously, but I think I want to surface it so I can address it. I'm actually trying to do two things at once. On the one hand, I am trying to change the left. I mean, obviously, that's the target of my criticisms, but I am also trying to change the right. And I do have some evidence that it's working. So just in terms of the climate argument, you know, one of the most thoughtful Republicans, I think, in Congress is Congressman Dan Crenshaw. You guys know him. He's a prominent podcaster, incredibly effective with media. Whatever else you think of him, he read Apocalypse Never and was like, I think he would tell you that he agrees with most, if not all, of it. He wants to move the party away from climate denial. and wants to put nuclear more at the center, really natural gas and nuclear at the center of the Republican agenda. I just had Andrew Sullivan, who's a well-known never-Trumper and conservative, basically endorse my approach to climate change, which is nuclear. I'm a longtime anti-imperialist leftist. I don't know if I'd still be a leftist, but I remain. One thing I've never changed my mind on is that I continue to view military interventions by the United States government as almost always a mistake. And I see the move towards nationalism on the right as potentially very positive. Obviously, it could have some very negative consequences, but I think inconsistent with being pro-national is very consistent with embracing the kind of energy agenda that I'm proposing. Similarly, here, the big liberal or progressive thing that I'm proposing in San Francisco is universal psychiatric care. There's just no way that we can solve this problem with not having everybody covered. And I mean everybody, including teenagers who are experimenting with pills, they get on Snapchat, overdosing and dying. I mean, street addicts. We need to have universal psychiatric care. For me, it's been the thing that when I push back to conservatives, because we do agree on a lot of aspects of what I'm saying, that's the most difficult pill in San Francisco to swallow. And I am finding that when you kind of pair these things, which is basically enforce the law, shelter first, housing earned. So housing is not a right. Housing is something you would earn through abstinence or compliance with psychiatric care. And universal psych, that's an agenda that, I mean, it's even hard when you look at that whole agenda to be like, that's a right wing or that's a left wing agenda. I do think it sits more comfortably right now in the center right. I'm totally fine with that. But yeah, I mean, my ambitions are, I would love to see Republicans pick up both a nuclear heavy climate agenda and a shelter first, housing earned universal psychiatry agenda when it comes to homelessness. If that happened, I'd be delighted. I would view it as a huge success. On the other hand, if, you know, moderate Democrats in seeking to reform their ways in the wake of what I see as a big coming backlash against wokeism that's barely begun, if moderate Democrats make a resurgence and want to pick up a nuclear heavy climate policy and a shelter first, housing earned, universal psychiatry proposal to homelessness, I'll help them too. But you're right to identify that tension. And I hope at its best, the two books are making that tension creative and productive and not just destructive.
Well, yeah, I can say, you know, for me personally, it's very Apocalypse Never really changed my mind. Not even my mind, but just made me fully embrace nuclear to a level I probably was dispositional towards, but hadn't fully thought about. And same whenever it comes to this, because, you know, I think the disposition of a lot of people on the American right is just the lock 'em up approach of the 1980s, something that you yourself were involved in actively pushing back against. But also, you know, you don't want to just allow open air drug markets and what really is just amounting to abject cruelty for a lot of what is happening to the people who are in a lot of these camps, Austin, San Francisco, and elsewhere. So I'm curious then, Michael, can you lay out the actual specifics for what's wrong with the current enforcement mechanisms and what needs to be done about it? Because you do a really good job of putting this in the book.
Yeah, sure. And I'll just say too that I'm very proud of using as my case study the city of Amsterdam and the country of Netherlands. I did that deliberately. On the one hand, it was accidental because I just happened to be in Amsterdam talking to a major expert in drug policy. I was there for energy reasons. So part of it was accidental, but part of it was deliberate. Throughout the book, I was sort of like, should I be using an American city as a model? And I decided not to, in part because San Franciscans we're really snobby and we really define ourselves in contrast to East Coast cities, in particular to New York. But I certainly couldn't say we should do more like New York and shelter everybody, which is mostly what New York has done, at least up until the COVID pandemic. So I'm proud of having used Amsterdam as the model, because when people say, what do you want to do? I say, I want to do what we do in Netherlands. I think most people in San Francisco think of the Netherlands correctly as a very liberal city. It's a city you can smoke marijuana in, you can go to a rave, you can hire a sex worker. Nobody thinks of Amsterdam as a right-wing or conservative city because it's not. So what would that look like? You know, it's basically, so when I say shelter first, it means you have to build sufficient shelters for all of your so-called homeless population. We haven't done that in California. And this was one of the biggest shocking, those shocking discoveries of the book, and it took some work to get to it and to really show it. But basically, the so-called homeless advocates have deprived, have taken the funding that should have gone to universal shelter and put it into Housing First, ostensibly for ideological reasons. It also turns out to be a much easier way to raise money for campaign contributions.
Sorry, Michael, what's the difference between Housing First and that's confusing.
Yeah, sorry. So by shelter, I mean, look, it is confusing in the real world. Shelter just is just less private. It's often congregate. I mean, the simplest form of shelter, like a FEMA shelter, you might be in bunk beds, or you might have a curtain around your bed. You'd have to share bathrooms. I will say in the Netherlands, the shelters in the Netherlands are much nicer, but often people still have to share a room and share a bathroom. Housing First refers to basically people having their own single unit apartment with their own kitchen and bath, which costs somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million per unit. It's incredibly expensive, very slow to build. And so we felt like that was a human right for people, those very expensive units. And we've never put, I mean, it's shocking, but we've never kind of said there's a limit to it or there's some conditions. It's just sort of whoever shows up and says they need their own housing, we've said that they should get it. Naturally, we don't have enough housing for them, and so they end up living on the streets, and we don't have sufficient shelter. So my view is that there should be sufficient shelter. It may need to be congregate, certainly for a little while. Then people can earn potential housing for themselves, though probably not in the most expensive real estate markets in the country. You know, particularly if you know, you kind of go, who's the population that's unsheltered? So you can classify the homeless really into two categories: sheltered homeless, unsheltered. The unsheltered, the folks living in tents on the street, somewhere around 100% are suffering from drug addiction or untreated mental illness. According to the people that work with them, when you interview folks, they need to be in shelter. They're not safe on the streets. It's not okay. It's not compatible with city life. They're not going to like it in many situations because many shelters don't allow them to use drugs. And that's often why people are on the streets, but you have to require it for cities to function. Then I think if people want to get rehab, and this is maybe the most important element of it, is the universal psychiatry. So I'm calling it CalPsych, at least for California, which would be centralized psychiatric and addiction care for people. That would mean rehab, but often not in the cities where the open drug scenes have been. So if you're in San Francisco and you're arrested, let's say, for committing some crime, shoplifting, public camping, public defecation, and you get arrested or you overdose and a CalPsych van picks you up, they should be able to put you in a rehab facility right away. They should be able to get you on a methadone or Suboxone taper, which is an opioid replacement, right away. Should be no obstacles to that. And I'm not some prude or some abstinence only person, like that's fine. That's what they did in the Netherlands. And then you might want to be out in the country somewhere. You might want to be in some small city away from the open drug scene. You know, when a lot of American soldiers got addicted to heroin in Vietnam during the war there, and they came back home, it was painful to kick, but the vast majority of them got over their addiction because they just weren't surrounded by heroin. Same thing here. If they can be in rehab out somewhere in further distance from open drug scenes, they'll do a lot better. And then you have basically assertive case management, whereby people, you know, like there's a difference between somebody who's schizophrenic and 50 or 60 years old on the street addicted to meth and fentanyl. That's a really difficult case. They're going to require a lot of care. But a 25-year-old guy, you know, who's been smoking heroin or using meth for a couple of years should be able to get his life back together through rehab. You just need assertive case management. You need the services centralized and hierarchical, centralized at the state level. Because right now we have the worst of both worlds. We have both duplicative services within counties and then between counties, and then we have huge gaps. So classic story is somebody gets out of rehab or out of prison. The first thing they do is they get out, they go right back into the open drug scene and they overdose and often die. You know, you may know we had 96,000 deaths last year from drugs in the United States. That's an increase from 17,000 in the year 2000 when I got out of this work. So dealing with this drug problem head on is just a big part of it. But that's going to require, like I said, it's shelter first, housing earned, and then universal psychiatry.
You know, something I'd like you to get to is the tension between the point about human dignity you made towards the start of the episode and what you just said here, because, and this definitely flashed through my mind, I know it is going to flash through the mind of listeners, when you describe the shelter housing, that just does not feel dignified, right? So as you've kind of pointed out, it's San Francisco, it's incredibly wealthy. I hear 500,000 to a million and I'm like, oh, that's a lot of money, but you know, could they probably figure it out? Probably yes. So how do you balance those parts? Because I just I'm imagining living in a shelter with the psychiatric cases you just described just sounds really terrible. And I really struggle as someone who is not trying to advance a complete permissive system to say, well, maybe we should give people their own spaces, because man, like if you think an open air drug market's bad, I feel like an open air shelter could be just as bad too. So I'd love to hear how you think about the balancing act there.
Yeah, you have it just right. I mean, many shelters are terrible. People understandably don't like them. A big part of the reason is that they can't use drugs in the shelter, but also they can't often bring in their belongings or bring in their pets or be with their lovers. They have made some changes that we have shelters now that do allow more of those accommodations, more privacy, pets, lovers. There's a big debate about whether or not to allow drug or alcohol use inside the shelters. But yeah, you're right. It's been a problem. We have made some progress on it in terms of that we've rebranded them navigation shelters in San Francisco, but they basically are a bit more liberal and they do allow that. And actually people wanted to stay there. Look, a big part of it is just that they can't all be in San Francisco. It's just the NIMBYism alone. I mean, I'm just really tired. I'm 50. And so I'm just tired of, you know, shaking my fist and being like, NIMBYs are terrible. Yeah, it's terrible. NIMBYism.
Could you explain that debate that you're getting at, the NIMBY well, thing?
Yeah. I mean, you have not in my backyard neighborhood people, which is basically everybody that doesn't want a homeless shelter in their neighborhood. And then you have YIMBYs, yes, in my backyard, activists, often millennials, kind of yuppie millennials saying we should have more housing. And it's really not gone anywhere in the sense that it just hasn't resolved in much more housing. We did, make some modest changes in California, but nothing like the scale that's required. And so for me, the obvious answer is that, yeah, you should have a right to shelter. I actually agree that the shelter quality should be higher than it's been in the past, but that's not a right to shelter in the most expensive real estate in the country. That's just not reasonable to do that. So I think you always have to be like, what is the fair exchange? I think as a human right, I do support shelter, but it can't be in San Francisco necessarily. Building shelter at much lower cost, even just like an hour outside of the Bay Area or outside of LA is much, much cheaper. With redevelopment, actually, you could do a lot more than in LA, which is just a much bigger area and has a lot more. And Skid Row is redeveloping. It could redevelop a lot more. The other thing we know is that it's important not to concentrate difficult populations, meaning often dual diagnosed, addicted and mentally ill populations. It's good not to concentrate them in one neighborhood. That again raises some NIMBY issues, but I think there are ways to solve that, especially if it's not at the state level. But yeah, I mean, I went to the shelters in the Netherlands and I was like, these are really nice shelters, really nice. Like people, and even there you would interview the people in the shelters and they would complain about having to share a room. Everybody wanted their own room. And then I would see the social worker that I was shadowing and be like, all right, well, you can have your own room, but you got to start going to that job that we arranged for you, or you got to start taking your meds because you're still psychotic. And there's always tension there. You're always trying to move, there's a bit of you're trying to move people towards greater independence. And again, for schizophrenics, a miracle a beautiful outcome for schizophrenics is that they can have their own room in a group home. That's a fantastic outcome. But for just your 25-year-old, seeker type, spiritual type, artist type who finds themselves addicted to hard drugs, who could get their life going again, independence is really a possibility, but you need that firm caseworker pressure and some of that legal pressure as well. But yeah, there's no reason that we couldn't have decent shelters for people. There's no reason that people have to be in FEMA shelters or congregate shelters, given the amount of space and the amount of resources that we have in California.
One thing, Michael, I want you to emphasize, which is that in that best case scenario, the 25-year-old addicted to heroin, possibly fentanyl and more. Why is the current system actually making things worse? I think this is one of your most compelling points because it is done out of what people think is altruism, but is actually furthering people's addiction, furthering criminality like rape and abuse by drug addict or by drug dealers and drug addicts and other people around them. Just talk to us sort of about what this environment looks like for the people who we should all have compassion and want better outcomes for.
Yeah, and I should say that, you know, I think one thing that has been that is slightly different from my view from some conservative writers over the years have emphasized that people on the street are there by choice. I think that is a stretch to say that people that are addicted to hard drugs like heroin or fentanyl or meth are doing much by choice. Really, addiction is really serious mental disorder. There are people, you know, if you're addicted to heroin or fentanyl, you're using every 4 hours, except for in the middle of the night, which is the time that you can sleep for sometimes they can sleep often for 10 or 12 hours. But really the rest of the day, you're just thinking about being high. You're either high or you're thinking about how to get your next, you know, hit and stay high. I don't think that's someone that can be described as having a lot of freedom of choice. You know, when you interview recovering addicts, including recovering homeless addicts, they'll tell you that some of the periods that they were most grateful for were the times that they spent in jail, where they had been arrested because it gave them time to be detoxed and to be free of drugs for some period of time and to recover, often from starvation. I mean, I don't know if you know, you've seen meth addicts, but heroin addicts too, they become very thin, in part as a consequence of the drug use, in part because all their resources are going to the drugs, in part because they're not sleeping much. You know, we have a coalition that we've organized in California of recovering addicts, parents of street addicts, and parents of kids killed by fentanyl. And every week people talk about their stories. And we have one woman who's in recovery, lost the husband of her baby to a heroin overdose. And she was like, I was always grateful for the time I spent in jail. Part of the thing is that when you stop arresting people at all, they never get a break. So we're dealing with people now that have really, really severe amounts of fentanyl and meth addiction. Really, honestly, never in human history have we had such a large number of people so addicted to such intoxicating, such addictive, and such deadly drugs. That's how you get hundreds of deaths a year. It's just a kind of dogma when you talk to people and they're like, no, we can't arrest people. It's wrong to arrest people. They're projecting onto real world people a kind of ideology, you know, that just says it would be wrong, you know, because the police are evil, because the criminal justice system is evil. You know, it's not more evil than letting people die, in my view. I don't think it's complicated at a moral level. But that is what's happening. And, you know, look, there's just a lot of people. I have three high school friends, two of whom are dead. I have three high school friends that have been homeless addicts. Two are dead. One I spoke to a few weeks ago and we had a very difficult conversation, because I confronted him on some stuff and didn't go well. It's very hard to do. But, you know, he had told other friends of mine that he felt he needed to be on probation, has been arrested for DUIs in two different states, has struggled with cocaine addiction and alcoholism, has been homeless. He has said that he needs to be on parole. And that's one thing that you hear a lot from people is they say, I felt like I need to be on parole. I need that supervision. Other people benefit from having ankle bracelets. These measures, it's not great. We would rather not have to put our, you know, fellow humans in ankle bracelets or on parole, but it's a hell of a lot better than dying or committing crimes or living in an open air drug scene. So some of it is, for me, it's an appeal to be practical about these things and to recognize that often when you're talking to street addicts, it's the addiction that's talking, you know, not free will or human agency.
You know, something I'm wondering as you're articulating this, you've made a couple references to your time really focused as an activist in these spaces during the 1990s. So something I'd like you to get at here is, what did the progressive activists who were responding to the 1980s, to Reaganism, to the old status quo, right? We're critiquing the status quo then. What about their work attracted you? So what about Maxine Waters attracted you? What did they get right when they were critiquing a world that, for good or for ill, we no longer live in?
Yeah, sure. So just to take you back before you guys were around, maybe, or when you were very young, in the 80s, when I was in high school, we had Nancy Reagan saying, just say no to drugs. That was when we were all experimenting with alcohol and marijuana. It was also a period where there was, I think, a sharper division than maybe exists today between soft and hard drugs. There was a sense that marijuana was a bit safer than other drugs. I see a lot more willingness, at least among teenagers in California, to experiment with pills today. That would have never been something we thought of back then. But we thought just say no to drugs was dumb and simplistic. It was also a period of the crack epidemic. And so we were, really the first wave of homelessness in the 80s was a function of the crack epidemic, crack combined with alcohol, resulting in a lot of homelessness. And then a war on drugs that really was in many ways an overreaction and kind of badly done and overdone, disproportionately affected people of color, African Americans in particular, the disparate sentencing on crack and powder cocaine. It remains a longstanding issue. It was, as I point out in the book, it was actually advocated for by the Congressional Black Caucus. It wasn't imposed by white racists. It was something that was advocated for by the Congressional Black Caucus, but pretty quickly seen as, having a really tremendously negative effect on cities. I point out too that really only 20% of the people that are incarcerated today are in there for drugs, only 4% for nonviolent drug possession. So that issue has been exaggerated. But nonetheless, we were dealing with a period of mass incarceration, racially disproportionate. It felt, and I think to some extent still was, an overreaction to crack and cocaine. I and others really fell in love with this idea of rehabilitation rather than prison. It's been much more successful in Europe than in the United States, but always felt like there was a better model of using a sort of case management and rehab and parole and probation. And we didn't have ankle bracelets back then, but the idea would be something that kind of gets into that in-between space, that gray area in between not enforcing the law and prison for 25 years. So that was really what motivated us. Needle exchange was, of course, came right out of the AIDS epidemic. And I should say that, my book, San Francisco, argues that it is a problem of good intentions. I don't think most people are evil or sociopathic. Certainly some people let their dogma get in the way of human, just practical human interaction. But, needle exchange came out of the AIDS epidemic, trying to prevent the transmission of HIV/AIDS. And really San Francisco's whole approach of treating addiction as a medical problem rather than as a criminal problem, comes out of our really compassionate and quite beautiful treatment of people suffering from HIV/AIDS in the 1980s. So I'd say it's both the combination of those two things, a reaction to the war on drugs, and then a reaction to a feeling of success on having been compassionate in our treatment of HIV/AIDS that led to this current situation of just absolutely enabling street addiction and not treating mental illness.
What does the middle ground look like then, Michael? One of the more compelling parts that I heard you discuss on the Rogan podcast was actually, and I hear this all the time from the progressive left, like, oh, in Portugal, they just legalized drugs and that fixed everything. Can you describe, like, as you had previously given an example, because I think it's very poignant, if you're in downtown Lisbon and you are shooting heroin in broad daylight, what's going to happen to you? Because I've seen that happen in San Francisco in my very limited travels there, and nothing happened to those people. What would happen in a place where drugs were legal?
Right. Well, this is one of the major talking points that you hear still. Is that they say the way that Europe solved this, the way that Portugal and Netherlands and Europe solved this was just by legalizing all drugs. It's not the case. I was so annoyed by this that I actually arranged a Zoom interview with the head of Portugal's drug program. And I asked him that same question. And he said, yeah, if you're caught shooting heroin in public, you'll be arrested and taken to the police station. And if you have an amount above the amount considered for possession, you'll be prosecuted for drug dealing. If you have an amount allowed by the law for drug possession, you will be brought before a commission for the dissuasion of addiction, which is as sort of Orwellian and terrifying as it sounds. It's it's not criminal proceeding, but it is like a misdemeanor proceeding effectively. And it involves your family members. It involves prosecutor. It involves often psychiatrist, social worker. And so there is consequence. And that's how Portugal does it. And, you know, can we do that here? You know, part of it, we don't have these strong social ties that they have in Europe. I mean, I'm always struck when I go to Europe that families are just much tighter and closer. You know, Europe is just small. And so most people, like in the United States, a lot of us don't live anywhere near our families and friends. Whereas in European countries, often people might live in the same city or an hour away, and it's easier to put that family pressure on, and those social bonds are tighter just for historical reasons. Americans were very independent, very libertarian. I think a fair number of people, addicts included, would rather just go through the normal criminal justice system rather than having their parents involved or their family members involved. So that's part of why I chose Netherlands. Netherlands is a bit more modern, a little bit less family oriented, a little bit more formal. They will use those family mechanisms. But I do think it is possible to use legal mechanisms and create not a substitute family. Nobody wants the nanny state, but something that's going to help people to and offer care. I mean, really, the character in my book, the Dutch character, he just says, Mike, you know, it's just carrots and sticks. You know, and if you're just giving people housing, it's not serving its role as a carrot. To be a carrot, it has to be a reward for good behavior. And so I think that's the key, really, is just carrots and sticks, consequences, enforcing the law, but also offering people a chance at every instance to be rewarded for making good choices, improving their lives, improving their behaviors.
There's a elephant in the room, the tech industry. It's kind of funny that we're nearing the end of this interview, and we made it, you know, a good 40 minutes without talking about tech and the wealth of tech and the billionaire class. When you see any conversation, let's say on The Daily by the New York Times or a typical bit of writing about this issue, they will talk about the tech industry's various alleged degrees of complicity when it comes to these issues. Where do you come down on that issue? And this is probably the most San Francisco. This is San Francisco. This is Seattle. When looking at those two cities, like, that is the central part of that conversation. How do you think about it? Because those people are, in weird ways, they're like, Mark Benioff is kind of a progressive, but he's also like not a progressive in the way that a progressive listener would say they're a progressive. So let's put those definitions aside. Where and what role does the tech industry play in this discussion?
Sure. So the main criticism of the tech industry by progressives in San Francisco and Seattle is just that they drove up rents by bringing so many people into the cities. I honestly don't think it's a fair criticism. I mean, it's not like we don't require businesses to build housing for their employees. Businesses create, their job is to create jobs, and really it's the job of cities to create the housing. So for me, that's not an appropriate criticism. I also defend tech employees from one of the common heard criticisms, which is that tech workers don't care about homeless people. One of the things that gets said about by progressive or radical left homeless activists about critics of the policies is they say, you just don't want to look at the homeless, as though people don't actually care about people. They just care about aesthetics. That's not fair at all in my experience. My experience is that when people express discomfort at seeing people in mental distress or physical distress living on the streets, that's an expression of empathy. That's a sign that they do care. It like, none of us should want to see people suffering on the streets or being denied medical care or in psychotic states. It's a sign of empathy. And to the extent to which they're showing concern about their own public safety, you should be concerned about that. But that's not a fair criticism. I have a different criticism of the tech industry, and I'll be soft about it because I don't think the tech industry has shown the leadership, the civic engagement, or the community involvement or the political leadership that it needed to. You mentioned Mark Benioff. He does not come off well in my book. He used his wealth to basically grandstand and moralize in support of just putting more money into enabling street addiction rather than into actually addressing the problem with carrots and sticks like they've done in Europe. I think that's a real disservice. There's other tech leaders who have known what the right paths have been. And I highlight a couple who I think deserve some courage, in particular, the CEO of Stripe, Patrick Collison, took a very brave stand in arguing for reform and was shouted down. And really, he had no benefit in doing so. He may regret it. But I haven't seen the kind of activism or political leadership from the tech community that I think we saw from like earlier industrial magnates, you know, the Carnegies or the, you know, the civic, the business, you know, the Fords, some of whom were, you know, probably reactionary and whose policies I may not share. But if you're a rich guy in general, those are supposed to be your community leaders. Often they are divided, and that's okay, between left and right, but they're sort of taking some responsibility. Look, we've just seen a lot of tech guys, they can get up and go. And this is a problem of the somewhere versus anywhere people. The anywhere guys, they get on their jets and they fly to Miami, is sort of a stereotypical place, or Austin. And they haven't sort of gotten involved in saving their city. That said, we do now have a recall campaign against the district attorney. We have a recall campaign against a couple of San Francisco school board members. So we are starting to see some people stepping up. I do think some of these guys were just really young, these really, really wealthy tech guys. You know, try to say this delicately, I think not all of them have been particularly people or social animals, not high necessarily on the social and emotional qualities that are necessary for politics. I think a lot of them are arrogant and don't, you know, politics is sort of about being subservient to some extent, at its best, servant leadership, but at its worst, sort of being a brown noser. If you're rich and powerful, you don't want to do that. So I think some of that's been to blame. But it's, yeah. So I guess that's my, I yeah, think we're stigmatized for the wrong things, not praised for the right ones.
And as we're nearing the end, I want to close with this question before I throw it to Sagar, which is basically, let's get at what I think people mean when they criticize the tech industry, because the strongest points that you make, and these come through in the book, are these points of you see something. You look at San Francisco in the bad parts of it. I'm not alleging the whole city is like this. And you think that just doesn't make any sense. And that has a lot of rhetorical, like, I'm sorry, various progressive activists, NGOs, I'm not going to disbelieve my lying eyes here. Something here doesn't make sense with the status quo. I think the version of this that's pushing back against the tech industry is it's hard for normal people to see the sheer amount of wealth that has been created in San Francisco and the Barter Bay Area, yet see that level of trepidation and poverty. So at a core level here, why can there be so much wealth yet there be this much of a problem? I think that's what people see how little that makes sense, and that naturally makes us to say, well, that must be because the tech industry is playing some role in the misallocation of resources or gains or anything like that.
Yeah, well, that's right. I think it's understandable. Like, you look at people living in tents and you think that's a consequence of poverty, not a consequence of wealth. But the poverty is a consequence of addiction. It's this, the shanties, as they sort of look like, are different than the shanties in places like Brazil or India or Nigeria. They're not there because there aren't good jobs, or even that there's insufficient housing. They're there because people are suffering late stages of addiction, where they aren't working because they are high or searching out for how to get drugs. They've often overstayed their welcome at friends and family's homes by couch surfing. And many of them have been cut off from friends and family because they've stolen money from them, borrowed money from them, or become unreliable addicts. It's just a terrible consequence of addiction that you alienate friends and family. You know, the numbers are shocking. We went from, you know, $300 million per year spent on homelessness in San Francisco to basically take care of 8,000 homeless people to now we're spending around $800 million per year on maybe 10,000 homeless people. I mean, it's basically $100,000 that's being spent per person, and huge amounts is wasted on, you know, not kind of necessarily illegal, but kind of various forms of corruption of just paying a lot of different nonprofits to provide duplicative services rather than, but none of them requiring that people actually accept the treatment. So you have, like, you know, the classic is story is that you just have a lot of people paid to go out and offer services to street addicts who are like, no, I'm fine here, thanks. So that's a big part of what explains it. And then a big, another big part of what explains it is just the high cost of housing and the slow pace at which it's developed. And then just shocking fees. I think in LA it was like 30% of the total cost of a $750 or $1 million unit was going to fees, which is like soft fees for like attorneys or lobbyists and planners. So, I mean, there's definitely a homeless industrial complex here that's acting parasitically on taxpayers and siphoning that money. But it's not really the tech industry that's to blame, except for the extent to which the tech industry has failed to get engaged politically and try to fix the situation.
I actually think that's the perfect way to end it, Michael. We really appreciate you joining us. It's very insightful. Book, and I really encourage everybody to go and pick it up. We'll have a link in the description to our bookshop link. Is there anywhere else you'd like to point people?
That's great, Sagar and Marshall. Thanks for having me, guys. You can buy San Francisco and Apocalypse Never on up on Amazon. Those are the two books that where I make the case for saving our civilization, how to do it.
Sweet. All right. Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, guys.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.